listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at some of the upper Midwest's endangered species and what they say about our part of the world and even ourselves. First, we're catching up on some of the week's news from the state capitol. A proposal in the state Senate aims to ensure that the state budget gets passed on time, and two of Governor Walker's major proposals, a child tax credit and an economic development plan for the state's rural areas, are losing steam in the legislature. J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics.com. I talked to him earlier today. J.R., thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Well, State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has a proposal that he says would prevent one house of the legislature from holding up passage of the state budget. First, before we talk about how it would do that, give us some background. Why would he be bringing something like this up?
This is all because of last year, what happened with the budget, were dragged into September. Now, typically, the fiscal year ends on June 30th of odd-numbered years, and typically lawmakers want to have that budget done before that so the governor can sign the budget at or around, you know, July 1st, the new fiscal year starts. That didn't happen last time. We had the budget, you know, stalemated in, you know, May, June, July, to August, and finally in September they got it done. And when you're the same party in control of both House legislature and the governor's office, that's not a good look. This is also a symbol of the frayed relationships in the Capitol right now between Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, and Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker. Republicans have been in control of the Capitol, other than for a brief period after the 2012 recall elections, for about seven years now. It's been the same personalities. There's always dysfunction in the state Capitol. There's always tension in politics. And it's just gotten to the point where these guys have kind of, like, lost patience with each other. And here's another symbol of what that relationship is like at this point.
This proposal has some technical details, but in broad strokes, what would it do?
It essentially sets a trigger that if things drag on, here's the process the Senate will take up going forward to get the budget at least in its house. Now, the Senate has tools already at its disposal that it could use. We have a thing called the Joint Finance Committee. It's the budget committee. It's comprised of both houses. The Senate could take it up on its own, the budget on its own, if it wanted to. This just basically puts that trigger in the Senate rules and says, okay, June 30th, hey, if it's not done, here's what we're going to do to get that thing rolling going forward. Now, Republicans control the Senate right now. This would be in place for, you know, this session, which ends, you know, at the end of this year. So we'll see if they bring it back next year, if it's a symbolic move. And quite frankly, you know, what happens if Democrats win control in November? I mean, they could do away with the rule, but it's just a trigger to put in place going forward if this happens again.
And this is something that would be a change to Senate rules, so it's not, yep, like the Assembly would have to vote on it.
And that's key. You can't force the Assembly. One House can't force the other House to do something. So even if this is in Senate rules, the Assembly is under no pressure. You know, it would be symbolic pressure. The Assembly would be under no real crunch. All of a sudden, it would have to act because the Senate did this.
The implication seems to be that it was the Assembly's fault, the Assembly Republicans' fault, that the budget didn't get passed on time. I think Assembly Republicans might tell a different story, though, right?
Absolutely. The Senate GOP wants to put the pressure over there. Quite honestly, I've been covering the Capitol for almost 18 years. I've never seen a budget like the one we had last time. I've never seen the leadership from both houses come in the press room of the Capitol to basically rip each other during the budget process, which happened in, you know, late June last year. It was a unique experience, to say the least, and I think they're trying to avoid that happening going forward.
Now, switching topics, JR, the governor got behind a few different efforts this last couple of months, including one we're going to talk about in a while with the state lawmaker, the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. But a couple of the governor's other big proposals are also up against the clock. His idea for a $100 child tax credit, it passed, I believe, in the Assembly. The Senate's still in action. What's going on?
Essentially, this thing is in peril because they're not agreeing on the same version of the bill. For anything to go to the governor's desk, the exact same bill, exact same language, exact same bill number has to pass both houses. The Assembly took Walker's original $100 per child credit and tweaked it to add a sales tax holiday. They also had some other changes to it, but the big thing was adding a sales tax holiday the first weekend in August that would apply to a lot of, you know, most things you could buy under, I think, $100. That, to them, spread out the benefit of us having a bit of a surplus projected through this budget that ends in midnight 2019. The Senate Republican caucus does not like the idea of a sales tax holiday. In fact, they've rejected it before. So they're taking up on their calendar, at least right now on Tuesday, their version of the governor's proposal that just has $100 per child credit, no sales tax holiday. Well, unless somebody blinks or accepts other houses' position, that means it doesn't happen this session. And one of Governor Walker's key kind of state of the state calls would die. So that's an issue for them to kind of work out, and we'll see if they can pull together, but right now it looks like that thing is just not going to happen.
And meanwhile, Democrats are saying, hey, this sounds like a pre-election bribe.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it before. I think it was 2000, I want to say. There was a big surplus back then, too, and both parties agreed to send checks back to people back then. It's something similar, you know. Now, the call from Governor Walker has been, we have this surplus. It's time to kind of, you know, give it back to the people. So he's been pushed this as an idea to try and show symbolically to people, at least, you know, $100 per kid, that, hey, you know, we've got good things going here. This is because Republicans are being in control. Therefore, you should be happy with us come November. Not sure it's going to be enough to sway people, but that's part of the idea behind it.
Talking to J.R. Ross from WisPolitics about some of the news of the week in Wisconsin politics. Another agenda item the governor had gotten behind, this $50 million plan to boost rural economic development. Where is that now?
It did not make the Senate calendar for Tuesday, and that's fascinating because Governor Walker called for this in the State of the State address. And number two, this is a priority in part because rural voters are important to Republicans. They've done very well with them, and they want to keep them engaged come November. Well, if you looked at the poll numbers on Foxconn and the amount of money the state has dedicated to that project, it's not very popular outstate. So there was a thought that this proposal was an effort by Governor Walker to send a message to rural voters of, hey, I'm paying attention to your needs, your desires. You guys know you have issues with economic development. We're going to take care of you, too. But in the end, from what I've been told, the Senate Republican caucus was, some members were hesitant because of the cost. Yes, we have right now a projected $385 million net balance come mid-2019, but there have been all these bills passed to kind of chip away at that balance, and that's not a big pot of money compared to how much we spend as a state, you know, on an annual basis. So there's some fear of eating all that money away, that if something goes south in the next, you know, year and a half, it could cause problems. And two, the more you dole out now, the less you have next budget if you want to do something more substantive in terms of tax changes or new spending initiative. And oh, by the way, the Governor Walker is now calling for a school safety package that has a $100 million price tag. So all these things are adding up. The child tax credit, for example, that's $122 million, I think. The sales tax holiday that the Assembly Republicans want to do is under $50 million. So you start seeing, you add up 122, 50, 100, 50. It gets to be expensive real quick.
And as we wrap up, a national story in the news, in part because of a Wisconsin U.S. Senator, the Right to Try bill was voted down by the House on a special fast-track bill where they needed a kind of a supermajority.
Yeah.
And Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson's been a big supporter of this bill. Can you talk about what it would have done?
Well, basically, it gives people, if you are somebody who is ill and you don't have another option, it kind of creates a new one to try some experimental drugs. What they tried to do was for non-controversial bills, usually you can use this fast-track procedure. You need two-thirds vote to get through the House. It fell 7 votes short. There were a couple differences between this bill and the Senate one, though, and the Democrats who opposed it raised concerns that this was risky and unnecessary. They also pointed to stats that the FDA already approves, I believe, 99% of the 1,000 requests it receives annually to allow patients to use kind of unproven treatments. It's a program known as compassionate use, as I understand it. So they're saying, hey, you don't need this. You've already got this option there. But Johnson had pushed for this hard. It passed the Senate, I think, unanimously, if not overwhelmingly. So there are a couple options. Come back under normal rules and do this bill, that, work out some differences and try and find a compromise. So that's another option. But this is something that Johnson's been pushing for a while now. And he got a big boost from President Trump, I think, in January, called for people to get behind it as well.
And we'll keep watching that one. JR, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That's J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He was with us to check in on some of the top news of the week from the state capitol and from Wisconsin lawmakers in Washington. There are 23 species in Wisconsin that are considered endangered or threatened. They include the gray wolf, the rusty-patched bumblebee, and the prairie bush clover. A new book examines what endangered species can tell us about our part of the world and what they say about us. Adam Rain Arvidson is a science reporter and landscape architect in Minneapolis. He's the author of the new book, Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. It comes out next month. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, why are you fascinated by endangered and threatened species kind of in our own backyards here?
My fascination for the wild and rare really starts with the landscape itself. I grew up in the Midwest, but not in the upper Midwest, not in Minnesota, though I've traveled kind of throughout there and across Wisconsin numerous times. And for me, the landscape of the upper Midwest is this really fascinating place that is much more varied than people give it credit for. You know, when you think about the difference between the driftless area to the shores of Lake Michigan, there's a huge variety there. And there are endangered and threatened species in every one of these types of landscapes. And, you know, I think that they're a really important part of those landscapes and that there might be something that we'd miss without having them there. So I come at it from a landscape perspective, but in researching this, I've learned a lot of interesting stories about these species themselves.
Yeah, you were, you know, not just kind of sitting at home writing about this. You went out with people, you know, collecting mussels from waterways and looking for these hard-to-find plants, elusive mammals, too, for that matter. What does it look like when you're out in the field seeing these endangered and threatened species in their own homes?
Well, for each one of these species, there is a dedicated scientist or group of scientists that spends sometimes an entire career studying them, learning how they make their living, learning what they're contributing to the landscape, how they're living in that landscape. And they are out in the field. They have to go out in the field and do this. And many of them were very generous with their time with me to let me tag along and sometimes help out with the surveys. I in the driftless area of Minnesota, I got to climb to the top of a 30-foot aluminum step ladder propped up against a cliff so that we could look at this rare plant that literally grows out of the cliff. I've been hip deep in the snows of the Northwoods, looking for lynx, following their tracks. I even kind of went out on my own and kayaked the shores of Wisconsin Point near Superior to look for areas that have been restored for piping plover habitat. So it's been fun to get out there and get up close and personal with this landscape, and many of those stories are related in the book.
Now you profile a bunch of different species of a bunch of different types. Before we get into maybe a couple specifics, you wrap up with some concern about our commitment to protect endangered species. What has you worried?
What has me worried is that, you know, we are 50 years removed from a real outpouring of environmental legislation that took place in the 60s and 70s. We had the Endangered Species Act in 1973, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. All these were passed right around that time. And incidentally, there was a whole lot of environmental literature that was going on at that same time, starting with the famous Wisconsin ecologist Aldo Leopold, who actually said that the first rule of responsible tinkering is to keep every part. And I really feel like we're losing some of those parts. And that 50 years later, we've sort of entered a situation where instead of the old sort of bipartisan way of looking at environmental legislation, keep in mind most of that landmark environmental legislation was signed by President Nixon after bipartisan efforts in Congress. Here we have really a battle between ideologies, and it's causing the Endangered Species Act itself to suffer. I think there's a lack of funding kind of going along with that right now. And we may really see some of these things wink out. And people hear a lot about the wolf, for instance, maybe the lynx. But there's a lot of other plants and animals that are smaller, they're less flashy, but they may play a critical part in our landscapes. And I think right now it's difficult to think that at a moment when we need to sort of reboot after 50 years, we're actually maybe taking a step backwards.
We're talking to Adam Rain Arvidson, author of the new book Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. Well, let's turn to something a little less flashy, as you're just mentioning, mussels. And when we hear mussels in the news, we hear about kind of the bad guy of the region, the zebra mussels, the invasive species. There's a lot of mussels native to this part of the world that face threats. Talk about some of those characters.
So these are characters indeed, and freshwater mussels are actually one of the hardest hit types of animals that we have across the Midwest, and they have such spectacular names. Like, one thing I love about them is what they're called. There are five endangered mussels in Minnesota and Wisconsin because we share many of the same rivers. You know, names like the winged maple leaf, the sheep nose, the snuff box, the Higgins eye pearly mussel. You know, these animals can live to be almost 100 years old. And they're in a lot of the big rivers, the St. Croix, the Mississippi. And they've really been impacted over the past 50 years, really, by water quality. And we're not that long removed from a time when sort of raw sewage could be dumped into the rivers. And things have cleaned up considerably. And there's actually significant efforts to be reintroducing mussels to the big rivers of the Midwest. And there's been some huge success funded in part by money that comes with endangered species listing. So there are scientists out there literally scuba diving in the Minnesota, the Mississippi, the St. Croix, finding these mussel beds, and in some cases cultivating mussels in labs and reimplanting them back into the river now that the waters are cleaner.
And they play a role in water quality, the food chain themselves, right, these freshwater mussels?
They do. The mussels are filter feeders, and so they are essentially opening up their shells and taking river water into their shells and eating the junk that flows down the river. So they do. There is a link to water clarity and water quality. The thing that's pretty fascinating about mussels is that in order to reproduce, they actually need a fish host. They're semi-parasitic, and mussels will actually catch a fish in their shell and flush their larvae over the fish's gills. And the tiny little mussels, called glochidia, ride on those gills for a time, and then they drop off when they're mature enough to live on their own. And the mussels have devised some pretty ingenious ways of doing this. Some of them almost put out a lure that looks like a worm that the fish will bite on. There's one mussel, the snuffbox, which simply pretends to be a rock. And when fish start turning it over looking for food, it snaps shut on that mussel's face and won't let it go until it's got some glochidia attached to its gills.
I want to take a look at one of the plant species that you feature, the prairie bush clover. It's listed as threatened here in Wisconsin, I think. And you call it a kind of a minor player in the book, and you ask, you know, why does it matter? And what did you find out about why the prairie bush clover matters?
The prairie bush clover matters, in my view, in a somewhat philosophical way. So the story of the prairie bush clover is the story of the rather rapid conversion of an entire ecosystem, the prairie, to cropland over a very short period of time. So around the turn of the 1800s, 1900s, over the course of about 40 years, the United States lost 99% of its prairie. And that's a total acreage that's about half of what the Amazon rainforest constitutes today. And nobody much said anything about it. And the prairie bush clover is endangered. The prairie itself is really endangered. And so the question that I ask in the book is, you know, we don't know what specific component the prairie bush clover plays in the prairie, but we also don't know what other species we may have already lost by essentially changing this ecosystem so extraordinarily. It also illustrates a point of the power of the Endangered Species Act. This is a legislation that works. Because the prairie bush clover is listed, its habitat has to be protected. And there's been a lot of effort across the Midwest, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and elsewhere, to make sure that there is prairie set aside and preserved legally so that the prairie bush clover can survive, but there's a whole lot of other friends that it has in that landscape that now get a place to live because it was protected by legislation.
Adam, as you mentioned, you did a lot of hands-on work with scientists, meeting these species in person when possible, and in some cases you were out there with your kids looking at these species and being out there with the next generation. Does that kind of shape your thinking about wanting to keep these things around for them to see and maybe their kids to see and so on down the road?
Oh, I think it's absolutely critical. You know, I've been working on this book for about 9 years, and my oldest son is 9 years old. So he has traveled with me throughout the Midwest at various stages of his development. And it really hits home for me with the butterflies. We've seen a huge crash in butterfly populations, especially prairie butterflies. They're virtually gone from the Midwest. And the butterfly is an absolutely amazing creature that sort of every kid can recite the Hungry Caterpillar book. And they have an affinity for butterflies. And it's a little scary to imagine a time when they won't go out into the field and see butterflies. And so I think there's an importance on preserving that, too, even if just to make sure that the kids understand the richness that we have of life here on Earth.
And briefly, as a wrap-up, I mean, there's a lot of sad stories or worrisome stories, but there are success stories. When we do things, it often works.
That's true. We've seen some real rebounds in places. I just mentioned butterflies. The Minnesota Zoo has raised captive prairie butterflies and successfully released them into the wild last summer. So that's a huge, huge bright spot. The piping plover, apparently there was a nesting pair in northern Minnesota this year for the first time in nine years, a pair nested on the shores of Lake of the Woods in Minnesota. And then, you know, I think the lynx has been proposed for delisting, in part because the science has shown that it's actually has a fairly robust population in northern Minnesota. I think there's always cause for hope. But the Endangered Species Act really works, and it's important to keep that in place, both for the purposes of research and to make sure that there's funding coming to that research for these animals and plants.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Adam Rain Arvidson. His new book is Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. Now, the state assembly unanimously passed a bill last month that would close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison and pay for new state and county-run facilities to replace it. This week, the Senate passed a revised and rewritten version of the bill that doesn't include funding for new facilities. That could ultimately mean that nothing ends up going to the governor's desk. Representative Evan Goyke is a Democrat from the state's 18th Assembly District in Milwaukee. He was the author of an early proposal to close Lincoln Hills. Representative Goyke, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
Let's start with a listen to Governor Walker speaking in his State of the State address, talking here about youth corrections.
Instead of one or two large facilities, which has been the model in Wisconsin for decades, our reform plan will create six smaller facilities spread throughout the state. Locations for five of the sites would be determined by collaborating with the 72 counties, since the offenders are sent to state facilities from individual counties. The other facility would be right here at Mendota Mental Health Institute as part of the nationally recognized program for mental health treatment. The complex in Lincoln County would be converted to a medium security adult prison. It would likely focus on alcohol and drug abuse treatment.
And Representative Goyke, we've talked to you about these issues before. How much agreement was there, bipartisan, on doing something along the lines of what the governor was talking about there?
Well, I think in the intro, I think you mentioned that the ultimate bill passed the assembly 95-0. So obviously that's a sign that there was broad bipartisan support. You know, having worked on this issue for a number of years, I can tell you in the beginning, it was a one-party effort. Democrats were leading the charge and coming up with idea bill after bill, you know, hearing after hearing. We were really pushing this issue. When the governor turned the corner on his support for this proposal, you saw a number of Republicans come to the table that had previously been quiet supporters or silent supporters, I guess, of our efforts. What we came up with was a blend of a number of ideas, some that mentioned by the governor, others that were pending legislative proposals, but ultimately we came up with a collaboration in a bill, Assembly Bill 953, that passed the assembly unanimously with broad bipartisan support in the legislature and the support of a number of important groups outside of the legislature, especially those that would implement the bill, like county leaders from around the state.
We've talked a lot about the troubles and scandals at Lincoln Hills over the last few years here on the show. You've been working on this for some time yourself. Can you remind us of some of the key reasons that you thought, okay, it's time to not send all the youth to this one facility? We need smaller facilities around the state.
So I think most listeners are probably quite familiar with the number of scandals of abuse of both students or inmates and staff, lawsuits that are pending. What listeners may be less familiar with, though, is that the facility is not efficient, that we're not getting a return on investment. It costs just under $400 a day per kid per day. So it's about $140,000 per year per kid. And at the end of the day, roughly 60% of those youth were reoffending or committing another crime within 3 years of release. So beyond the moral and ethical call for closing the facility from the scandals that investigations that were going on, there clearly was also an economic argument to closing the facility. It wasn't working. It's not working effectively to prevent repeat offending of the youth that were there. And what we did then is, so if the status quo is not working, you've got to come up with a solution. And as I did research and looked nationally, states that have engaged in juvenile justice reform in the last several years are moving towards this new model, which is keep the youth as close to their families and to their school districts and to their communities as possible. And small sizes matter. So and why that is, it's all about relationship building, building stable, meaningful, trustful relationships with adults. And that the smaller the facility, the better that's able to happen. And that's where we see true, meaningful rehabilitative work take place. And that's why in other states that have these smaller regional facilities, you have lower recidivism rates than Wisconsin currently has.
Talking to State Representative Evan Goyke about efforts to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Corrections Facility. As we mentioned, Representative Goyke, this passed, a plan passed unanimously in the Assembly. Now, the Senate has passed a plan to close it, but it's different. What changed there?
First and foremost, the plan that passed the Senate does not have the funding necessary to begin the plan right away. It maintains a small amount of the funding to do the rehabilitation or expansion of the juvenile mental health facility in Madison. That's a component of the Assembly bill as well. But from there, what the Senate did is make everything, they stripped all of the money and the urgency out of the bill. And rather than acting, the Senate bill has a study committee which must then recommend to the legislature what to do by February of 2019. I would argue that there isn't a debate about what we should do. The solution is right in front of us, and we don't need to wait another year to be told what we already know today. And so I'm concerned that the Senate version not only puts in jeopardy the plan that unanimously passed the Senate, but that it, even if that's the version that passes, it doesn't act fast enough to solve the problem.
And because there are two different plans here, they're not worded the same. They ultimately have to be the same bill to be sent to the governor. The leadership in the Assembly says we're not coming back in regular session. So if two different plans pass, we could end up with zero plan. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. And that was the message that I've been communicating to my Senate colleagues on both sides of the aisle. Any change to the plan is a potential, the potential for immediate change. And I will say this, the Senate has released its official calendar for Tuesday, March 20th. That's the final day they will come and vote on legislation. On their calendar for Tuesday is the Assembly version of the bill. Now, I'm hearing all kinds of rumors and conjecture that the Senate may make changes to the Assembly bill, but I can tell you this, on Tuesday, the state Senate has an opportunity to vote in support of the unanimous bill that passed the Assembly and get it done send the bill to the governor. We're confident the governor, he said publicly that he supports the bill. So we can bring swift and immediate action on Lincoln Hills on Tuesday if the Senate and the Senate Republican majority leader decides to vote on the bill. It is on their calendar. I do not believe there is any sound policy justification for their version of the bill versus the Assembly. I'm calling on them to support the Assembly version. And quite honestly, beyond that, I'm calling on Republican leaders outside the Senate, in the Assembly, in Governor Walker and the Department of Justice, to get into the halls of the Capitol on Tuesday the 20th, engage and lead on this issue, talk to the Senate Republicans and get it done. And certainly we did that in the Assembly. It's the Senate's turn, and it could happen on Tuesday.
We're talking to Representative Evan Goyke about a legislative effort to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Correctional Facility. Representative Goyke is a Democrat from the state's 18th Assembly District in Milwaukee. He's an author of early proposals to close Lincoln Hills. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Lincoln Hills be closed? Do you want to see it, if so, closed soon? What should replace it? What do you think of this idea of replacing the one big facility with smaller facilities around the state closer to home for the inmates or students there? What do you think of the way lawmakers are handling this issue with two different plans here? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Representative Evan Goyke stays with us to talk about dueling bills in the legislature in the effort to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. He's a Democrat representing the Milwaukee area. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Representative Goyke about how this is going in the legislature? Do you think that Lincoln Hills should be closed? If so, quickly or in a longer-term process? Do you have an experience at Lincoln Hills as a past inmate, a parent of one, or somebody working there? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Representative Goyke, Senator Van Wongert, Republican from Racine, he's the chair of a committee that passed the amended Senate bill. He said, hey, senators are worried about the cost of the plan. It wasn't clear enough at this point what new facilities would cost. That's why they wanted to change things. What do you think about that?
Well, I think if you want a new system with new facilities, there's no way to escape costs. So I don't understand what he thinks waiting a year is going to do to alleviate that concern, because guess what's going to come up in a conversation a year from now? It's going to cost money to build new facilities. The end of the day, the point of doing this is to reduce recidivism through better treatment and better programming, more effective facilities. So if the goal is reduce crime and add to the future quality of life of these young people, at some point it's going to cost money to design and construct these new facilities. And we knew that all along. Everybody knows that. That's common sense. It would be illogical to think that you could just do all of this for free. So if the argument really is about money, delaying action on it for a year is only going to cost more a year from now. The Senate version of the bill, it doesn't avoid spending money in the future to make these system changes that are needed. It just delays the debate about when we should get it done. So I think waiting a year, it's going to cost more. And if that's the big argument, it really is false, quite honestly. He's wrong. It's going to cost more a year from now. But we might as well act now. You've had me on the program before to talk about the adult side of the justice system, and I just want to make this point. Converting that facility to an adult facility actually has enormous cost savings for the state of Wisconsin. We spend about $24,000 per day to pay county jails to house adult inmates because there's no room in the adult systems. If we can convert Lincoln Hills to an adult facility, that would relieve those jail beds and save $24,000 a day. So just to counter Senator Wangard's argument about cost, the sooner you do this transformation of the facility to an adult, the sooner you save $24,000 a day.
want to look at the estimated closing date, aiming for January of 2021. Are there thoughts as to, okay, how do we fix things in Lincoln Hills between now and then?
So we've had those discussions, and certainly all of the authors on both sides of the aisle that have been working on this bill are not ignorant and do not want to ignore the problems that are there today. I think it's been very challenging, quite honestly, in my 6 years in office to get the majority party to act on the conditions now. I think some of the things that could be done immediately to address the concerns revolve around how the employees are treated in the workplace and their voice in the Department of Corrections. I've heard from a number of staff members that are there now. They don't have control over forced overtime, the number of vacant positions that are still left unfilled puts pressure on all of the remaining staff members to fill those unfilled shifts. All of that can be done now by the Department of Corrections. It wouldn't take a bill or an act of the legislature to do what's needed to fill those vacant positions and hire more folks. They've got to do that. One thing we're seeing is that it's hard to recruit people and hard to retain people at that facility. And so at least as it's currently operating as a juvenile facility. And so, again, the faster we make these system changes, I think the faster we bring relief to those folks that are working there today that are under an incredible amount of pressure and have not seen the type of swift action and relief that they need from the executive branch, from the governor's office and the Department of Corrections.
I want to bring on a caller now. Janine is with us in Eau Claire. Janine, hi.
Hi. I just want to make a comment, and then I'll take my whatever response off the air. When I was 14 years old, these same problems, shortcomings, the abuses, the neglects, the kids suffering, that was going on then. And I don't think that it's a matter of budget or a senator who wants to go home for vacation. These kids are suffering, and it needs to be dealt with now. Figure the budget out later. These are still minors. They're kids. And I am 53 now, and this was going on then. So that's all, and thanks for taking my call. Bye.
Janine, thanks for the call. Janine sees long-term problems. We've been hearing about more serious problems since the merger from another institution, Representative Goyke. But Janine saying there's some urgency here.
I totally agree with her. And the plan that was unanimously approved by the State Assembly, the reason why I believe firmly that that policy, that bill, will bring the type of relief to the ongoing problems of these facilities, one is by making things smaller, it is much, much easier to keep track of the quality of life of 24 inmates rather than 224 or 124. And the second thing is, that the counties, these local regions or local county governments, will be far more responsible for running local programming. That, too, it is far easier for me as a Milwaukee community member to hold accountable the officials that are running a facility when it's in my backyard rather than when it's 3 hours away or when it's my county representative that's on a committee overseeing that facility than when it's the Department of Corrections and a major bureaucracy where it's hard to reach exactly who the decision maker is. So those changes will bring accountability and transparency to the local facilities. And I think knowing that and having those safeguards in place, that will result in better care and better outcomes for the juveniles that are housed there.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Goyke, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
That was State Assembly Representative Evan Goyke. He's a Democrat from the state's 18th Assembly District. That's in Milwaukee. He joined us today to talk about the newly written Senate bill that would close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. It passed on Wednesday. It's different than the unanimous Assembly bill passed. Now it's up in the air. The same bill would have to be passed to go to the governor's office. And as we've heard, it is on the schedule, the assembly version, to be voted on in the state Senate on Tuesday. Stay tuned to see what happens. Another item on the agenda in the state Senate. The Senate is expected to vote next week to expand funding for Governor Scott Walker's campaign to lure what he calls Midwest millennials here to Wisconsin. WPR's Laurel White went to Chicago to see if millennials there are ready to make the move.
The Fullerton L stop on the north side of Chicago starts getting crowded around 5:15 on this Monday afternoon. Each train car that passes looks fuller than the last. In their rush to get home, commuters smush themselves into the train cars before the doors warn them to get out of the way.
Doors closing.
On the platform, Danny Pace is waiting for a Brown Line train to take him home. He says he's seen the ads for Wisconsin inside the train cars.
I'm trying to remember the slogan. It's like, what is it? It's more you. Is that what it is?
Wisconsin, it's more you.
The ads have been posted in the train cars since January. Video ads are running on Facebook and YouTube. Pace says the ads are good, but he's not in the right life spot to consider a move.
Like early 20s, just got a job. Wouldn't really want to uproot and leave all my friends here. So.
Colleen Ferguson is also waiting to take the Brown Line home from work. The 30-year-old lawyer says the ad's messages about a lower cost of living in Wisconsin are compelling.
I would like that because, I mean, everyone has student loans these days as well, so you're focusing on paying those and other expenses like health insurance, so you kind of like the idea that there's a cheaper option out there.
Ferguson says she would definitely consider moving to Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker hopes other Chicago millennials feel the same way. He's asking lawmakers to approve a roughly $7 million expansion of the ad campaign.
We need to go beyond our borders to attract and then in turn retain more talent here in the state of Wisconsin.
Walker announced the plan at a meeting of business leaders in Madison late last year. He told them the campaign will also focus on shorter commute times in Wisconsin compared to urban areas in neighboring states.
Part of it is we can make a pretty compelling case about the differential between actually doing things in Wisconsin, out canoeing or enjoying a concert or having a drink with friends, as opposed to being stuck in commuting time.
William Fry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he studies population trends. He says studies have shown the number one driving force of getting millennials to move somewhere isn't low cost of living or short commutes or even density of cool coffee shops or concert venues. According to Fry, the key factor is available jobs.
I mean, a good example of that is when we had this very down economy for a good part of the last decade, North Dakota, of all places, was attracting probably more percent migrants than any place else in the country. Now, nothing against North Dakota, but there are other more, you know, high amenity places around the country people would like to live, but they went there because of the job.
Back on the train platform, Chicago resident Ian Frank says he'd advise against lawmakers approving the campaign.
So I lived in Milwaukee for a year, so I understand, but it also feels a little passive-aggressive. I feel like I'm being asked to reconsider my life choices, which is appropriate, but also feels a little like, back off, Wisconsin.
Frank said he'd consider moving back to Milwaukee if there was an arts job available. But for now, he's happy in Chicago. The new ad campaign might miss the mark with him, but Wisconsin Republicans are hoping it's a hit with other millennials. The Senate could pass the plan next week and send it to Governor Walker's desk for his signature. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Doors closing.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, there's over $1 trillion in unpaid student loan debt in the United States. A guest makes the case that it should be canceled, all of it, for the good of the people who are in debt and for the health of the economy overall. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.